Some internet companies are in shock after yesterday's ruling by an Italian court. Google executives were held responsible for a video on a Google site showing a boy being bullied. Web providers called the court's decision an assault on freedom. But NPR's Martin Costi reports that even before the Italian case, freedom on the internet has meant different things depending on where you live.
Google has framed this ruling as potentially disastrous. Spokesman Bill Etchison says expecting websites to vet everything that gets uploaded would be a threat to creativity on the internet.
It would mean the web as we know it wouldn't exist.
The thing is, the web as we know it doesn't really exist now, at least not in any one universal form. Things were more universal back in the 1990s, when websites especially were designed to be worldwide.
It's supposed to be uniform. One link consistently is supposed to point to a particular destination.
Jonathan Zittrin is co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He points out that website addresses are called URLs, uniform resource locators, but that that's turning into a misnomer.
More and more what we see are that depending where you are, one jurisdiction versus another, Canada versus the U.S., the U.S. versus Thailand, that uniform resource locator isn't so uniform anymore.
Your computer's IP address, the numeric code that shows where you are, directly affects what you get to look at. Brazilians can't watch Hulu. Americans can't watch the BBC. Usually this is done for commercial reasons. The website may have rights to show the movies only in certain countries. But sometimes this regionalization also happens because of government pressure.
We've seen an increasing ability to have a local internet that could conform to local law.
China is the obvious example, but companies like Google have also restricted access to their sites in other countries. For instance, in Thailand, where YouTube agreed to block locals from seeing certain videos that the government found insulting to the king. And then there's Europe, which has more restrictive privacy laws than the U.S. The Italian case, for example, was based on the fact that the kid being bullied in that video hadn't consented to having the video posted.
There are likely thousands of privacy laws that can affect any one piece of data.
Trevor Hughes is head of the International Association of Privacy Professionals. Those are the people who work at companies like Google trying to keep their websites compliant with all the different privacy laws around the globe. But sometimes, he says, it's just not possible for a single website to satisfy every country.
While the internet is indeed a global platform, we certainly see organizations that cannot find a lowest common denominator with regards to compliance, or perhaps it's a highest common denominator, and as a result need to segment their offerings significantly.
This segmentation of the internet comes as a disappointment to some of the American idealists who'd hoped that the internet would become a global free speech zone that would trump local authorities. But those idealists sometimes also forget that freedom can mean very different things in different places. Jonathan Zittrin quotes an aphorism that's familiar to many internet law experts.
In cyberspace, the First Amendment is a local ordinance and doesn't protect you anywhere else.
As the laws and customs of other countries weigh more heavily on the policies of companies like Google, Americans who are fond of their own concepts of freedom may someday be glad that the internet isn't quite as universal as it used to be. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. U.S. officials are looking into the role that Goldman Sachs and other big banks played in the ongoing debt crisis in Greece. The company has been accused of helping Greece hide its financial problems from investors and regulators, but it also may have made the country's fiscal troubles even worse by helping investors bet on the possibility of a default. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
As the Greek financial crisis lurches from bad to worse, some European officials have complained that part of the blame lies on this side of the Atlantic. And today came evidence that the allegations are being taken seriously. At a Senate Banking Committee hearing, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke revealed that the central bank is beginning to investigate some of the allegations.
We are looking into a number of questions related to Goldman Sachs and other companies and their derivatives arrangements with Greece.
The charges involve what are called cross-currency derivatives sold to the Greek government nearly a decade ago. At the time, Greece was lobbying to get into the European Union. The derivatives sold by Goldman helped Greece conceal the extent of its debt from EU regulators and investors by taking it off the government's books. Tim Bakshall is chief strategist at Credit Derivatives Research. He says there's nothing illegal about these transactions, but they're not usually used by sovereign governments, and the fact that they were has helped undermine the market's confidence in Greece.
What I think worries a lot of market participants is the not knowing, the uncertainty, and the fact that these kind of deals were going on certainly makes you wonder what you don't know.
More recently, Goldman has been hit with another set of allegations involving credit default swaps. These are a kind of complex financial instrument that enables investors to place bets on the financial condition of a company or a government, even if they don't have any financial ties to it. The market for credit default swaps is huge, and Goldman plays a major role in it. In this case, Goldman joined with other big banks to set up a kind of index that helps investors measure the value of the swaps held against Greece and other countries. Critics say this has turned into a kind of vicious cycle. Investors look at the index, see that a country's debt situation is growing worse, then they sell off its bonds, which makes the index go up even more. At today's Senate hearing, Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd said this contributes to an atmosphere of crisis and makes it harder for the Greek government to borrow.
Since there's no requirement that purchasers of credit default swaps actually own any of the underlying debt, we have a situation in which major financial institutions are amplifying a public crisis, what appear to be for private gain.
Others say Goldman's role in the crisis is being greatly exaggerated and that it's being scapegoated for problems caused by years of poor fiscal management by the Greek government. For his part, Fed Chairman Bernanke defended the use of credit default swaps, saying they were useful in helping companies and governments hedge against risk. But, he added,
obviously, using these instruments in a way that intentionally destabilizes a company or a country is counterproductive.
The question for the Fed is whether Goldman actually did that and what impact its actions had. As for Goldman, a spokesman today declined to discuss the charges, saying the company never comments on legal or regulatory matters. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Today was the day President Obama held his much-anticipated healthcare summit at Blair House and on live television. The day-long back-and-forth did not produce much bipartisan agreement. Soon after the summit was over, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said he was discouraged by the outcome, and he said once again that the process should start from scratch. He said the American people want the health conversation to start over.
They do not want this bill. It's time we started listening to the people that we represent.
Today's summit did illuminate at least one thing, and that's how both parties see the stakes in the healthcare debate. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
The president and the members of Congress sat around a big square table. There was no lectern for Mr. Obama. The Republicans had insisted on that. The president opened the proceedings with a plea for bipartisanship. As contentious as the effort to change the health care system has been so far, he said, people still want us to move forward.
If we're not engaging in sort of the tit for tat and trying to score political points during the next several hours, that we might be able to make some progress. And if not, at least we will have better clarified for the American people what the debate is about.
There wasn't much negotiating progress made, but there was a great deal of clarification. The 6 hours of talk revealed the scope of the gulf separating the president and the Republicans on health care. Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander was designated as his party's chief spokesman, and right away he pointed to the elections in Massachusetts, Virginia, and New Jersey to argue that the public doesn't like the president's plan. And Alexander answered the question he says he gets asked by Democrats. Where is the Republicans' comprehensive bill?
And I say back, well, if you're waiting for Mitch McConnell to roll in a wheelbarrow in here with a 2,700-page Republican comprehensive bill, it's not going to happen because we've come to the conclusion that we don't do comprehensive well.
Republicans don't share the president's goal of universal coverage. They prefer to focus on lowering costs. And Alexander had two demands for the president: abandon his own bill and promise not to push any bill through the Senate with the votes of Democrats only.
So if we can do that, start over, we can write a health care bill. It means putting aside, jamming it through. It means reducing health care costs and making that our goal for now and not focusing on the other goals.
The Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid responded to Senator Alexander's demand that the Democrats renounce the procedural maneuver called reconciliation, by which bills can pass the Senate with a simple majority instead of a filibuster-proof 60 votes. Reid, who is planning to try this strategy next, pointed out that it is not such an unusual step.
Remember, since 1981, reconciliation has been used 21 times. Most of it's been used by Republicans for major things, like much of the Contract for America, Medicare reform, the tax cuts for rich people in America. So reconciliation isn't something that's never been done before.
Throughout the day, the Republicans showed how confident they were that the public had accepted their main argument, that the president's plan was a government takeover. Here's Arizona Senator John Kyle.
There are some fundamental differences between us here that we cannot paper over. We do not agree about the fundamental question of who should be mostly in charge. Do you trust patients and doctors make the decision, or do you trust Washington?
But several other Republicans noted that 60% of health insurance in America already comes from the federal government. The president, returning to the White House for a lunch break, was so eager to blunt the sharp edges of the GOP talking points that he stopped to have a rare informal chat with reporters. He pointed out that the Republicans had already agreed on a lot of ways to regulate the health insurance industry.
The argument that Republicans are making really isn't that this is a government takeover of health care, but rather that we're insuring we're regulating the insurance market too much. That's a legitimate philosophical disagreement.
Legitimate and wide. Too wide to be bridged at Blair House today or on Capitol Hill anytime soon. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Author John Ray didn't write his third novel in an office or in a library. He wrote the book called Lowboy on the New York City subway, where it's set. And for our series You Must Read This, Ray recommends a book that helps him take risks with his writing.
One of the most enduring mysteries I've encountered, both as a writer and as a reader, is the question of why certain novels speak to me on the most intimate level, while other equally good books fail to cast a spell. Whatever the explanation, the experience I'm trying to describe is the single greatest joy that reading gives me. I've never felt it more strongly than when I read the first few sentences of Ridley Walker. Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban is set in a post-apocalyptic England in which all but the most basic civilization has decayed. The novel tells the story of the uneasy friendship between two adolescent boys, one a normal teenager, one a clairvoyant mutant, who happen, more or less by accident, on the secret of the atomic bomb. It begins with a bow and arrow hunt for wild boar and ends with a routine by Punch and Judy. What happens in between is a heroic quest, like The Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, although Hoban's book leads his hero into distinctly darker territory. There are no rings or magic wands in Ridley Walker, just knowledge and brute strength. This may sound like grim stuff, but the book's a delight. One of the defining features of the post-nuclear world Hoban has imagined is the fascinating broken-mirror way in which the reader can recognize fragments of contemporary culture in the new dark ages of the 23rd century. Place names are particularly fun. Sandwich has become Sam's Itch. Dover is now called Do It Over. And the Archbishop of Canterbury has been aptly renamed His Ardship. I came across the novel in the 99-cent bin of a used bookstore in Texas when I was fresh out of school, and the world it created, futuristic and medieval at once, was the perfect escape from the drudgery of my first post-college job. Ridley Walker, like Joyce's Ulysses or Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, takes a hammer to the staid, proper language most books are written in and builds something new and astonishing out of the pieces. These days, I keep a copy within arm's reach of my desk and open it at random whenever I get that slightly queasy feeling that my own writing has become a bit too safe. Hoban's book, for me, is that rarest of creatures, a work of uninhibited fantasy that we can recognize ourselves in clearly and possibly even learn from. What could be more exciting than that?
John Ray's latest novel is called Lowboy. He was talking about the book Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban.
For 9 years now, a private developer has been working to get approval for 130 wind turbines on Cape Cod. Local opposition has been strong. Now, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is poised to decide whether the country's first offshore wind farm can be built there. Sean Corcoran reports from member station WCAI.
The waters of Nantucket Sound were unseasonably calm when the Interior Secretary stood near the bow of the Coast Guard vessel Ida Lewis recently on his first visit to the proposed wind farm site. Here, the wind typically blows at an average speed of 19 miles per hour, making it popular with recreational sailors. But during Salazar's visit, not even a brief gust threatened his trademark Black Stetson, as he announced that after nearly a decade of review, it was time to decide the fate of the project called Cape Wind.
And I think the worst thing that we can do for the country is to be in a state of indecision, and this application has been in a state of indecision for a very long time.
Cape Cod is that arm-shaped peninsula that extends out from Massachusetts, and Cape Wind's closest 440-foot tall turbine would be 5 miles to its south in Nantucket Sound. It's shallow here, less than a foot deep in some places, which is one of the reasons Cape Wind officials insist it's the region's best location for an offshore wind farm. Whether that's true or not is now up to Salazar, and no matter what he decides about this project, Salazar says offshore wind power is coming to the United States.
But as I've always said, with respect to renewable energy on the onshore, it's important to do wind energy in the right places. That is the critical question that we're addressing here at Nantucket Sound. You know, is this the right place for wind energy or is it not?
For the past year, Cape Wind has been on a winning streak with court victories, state approvals, and a mostly favorable environmental impact statement from the federal government. Mark Rogers, the communications director for Cape Wind, says that since it first was announced in 2001, the billion-dollar project has garnered strong statewide support with its promise to meet two-thirds of the Cape's electricity needs while offering energy independence and fewer greenhouse gas emissions.
Cape Wind has wider and deeper support than any energy project in the history of New England. Leading environmental organizations, labor unions, trade associations, and just across the general public.
But most local officials here oppose its location in an area used by fishermen and boaters, and the local Chamber of Commerce says Cape Wind is a threat to the region's only industry, tourism. Until his death last year, the most prominent opponent was Senator Ted Kennedy, whose family life on Nantucket Sound was well documented. Now, the loudest voice against the project comes from two local Native American tribes.
We're the Wampanoag, people of the First Light, and it's our responsibility to greet that day.
That's Bettina Washington, the historic preservation officer for the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead on Martha's Vineyard. She says the project would infringe on the tribe's religious and cultural rights by interfering with their view of the rising sun, and it also may disturb archaeological evidence of tribal life.
The waters now cover what we know were ancestral homelands that we walked. We lived there. We went to the edge of those shores to fish, and we interred our dead in those lands that are now covered by water.
The strong Native American opposition may present the final hurdle for the project. Last fall, the Wampanoag successfully petitioned to have Nantucket Sound declared eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places, making the permitting process more difficult. Salazar met with the tribes for a sunrise ceremony during his visit to the Cape. He says he's taking their concerns seriously as he wades through all the issues, with an eye towards releasing his decision sometime in April. For NPR News, I'm Sean Corcoran on Cape Cod.
It is Friday morning and time for StoryCorps, the project that records conversations between friends and loved ones. Colbert Williams was just 16 when he became a father. He raised his son as a single dad. His son Nathan is now a teenager himself.
What were you thinking when I was born?
I guess as a 16-year-old who came from a situation where there wasn't a father, you know, my confidence level was probably as low as it possibly could get because I realized I was going to be responsible for some person. So I was scared. I had to start going into parenting groups where they would not normally have a 16-year-old boy. And, you know, I became more confident. I think the more you practice and learn, the more you get better at it. What's it like growing up with a teenage father?
Since you're younger, it's easy for me to, like, speak to you, and we'd be on kind of the same level.
Yeah. Is there anything you've always wanted to tell me but haven't?
I'm proud of you, because you're a really good father.
Wow. I'm proud of you. See, I ain't trying to get all sentimental. But I'm proud of you. I think the reason why I'm so proud of you is because you've allowed me to be a father. And I'm proud of you for allowing my voice to still have meaning. You know, growing up without a mom, you could have used that as your
crutch.
Your crutch to not move and not progress. And you haven't allowed that to happen.
What advice will you give me about raising my own kids?
Never give up. Even when you just don't understand what you're doing, always listen. And never stop holding their hands. It's okay for your son and daughter to be 14 and you decide just to hold their hand. That might be a little corny, I think. I don't know,
right?
If I held your hand, you'd be cool.
Love you, Dad.
I love you too, Nathan.
Gave you a few seconds there to dab your eyes. Colbert Williams with his son Nathan at StoryCorps in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Their conversation will be archived along with all the other StoryCorps interviews at the Library of Congress. And you can find the podcast at npr.org.